This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In August, the U.S. Justice Department issued a memo clarifying the federal government's response to laws in 20 states legalizing marijuana for medicinal or recreational use. The Justice Department said it will not sue to block those laws, and it will take a trust-but-verify approach to policy within those states. At a hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee in mid-September, Senator Patrick Leahy asked Deputy Attorney General James Cole about the new memo and how Cole felt about charges that the Justice Department was abdicating its responsibility for marijuana regulation.
We are not giving immunity. We are not giving a free pass. We are not abdicating our responsibilities. We are dedicating ourselves to enforcing the Controlled Substances Act in regard to marijuana when it implicates those federal priorities. And when we see somebody who is marketing marijuana in a way that's going to be attractive to minors, we're going to go after them. If we see somebody who's growing and cultivating marijuana so they can import it or export it out of state, we're going to go after them. If they're involved in drug cartels and illegal enterprises, we're going to go after them.
Vermont legalized medical marijuana dispensaries 2 years ago, and the first dispensaries opened in the state this summer. 17 other states have legalized medical marijuana, and two, Washington and Colorado, have legalized recreational marijuana use. Governor Peter Shumlin says he supports the legalization of marijuana, but he's in no hurry to have Vermont lawmakers consider the issue.
I believe that legalizing and taxing marijuana in the future for the states is going to be the direction this country takes, and Vermont should be a part of that conversation. But I am not either willing or proposing to do that this year. It's just not the top of my agenda.
Governor Shumlin spoke in response to the news that Vermont is one of 10 states where the D.C.-based Marijuana Policy Project plans to wage a campaign to legalize marijuana by 2017. We're going to hear from the Marijuana Policy Project today, as well as Vermont's Public Safety Commissioner on the idea of legalizing recreational use of marijuana. We'll also follow up on Vermont's current status as a state that does allow the medicinal use of marijuana. We'll talk with the head of the Burlington Dispensary, which has been in operation for a couple of months now. And finally, we'll talk with State Senator Joe Benning, one of the senators who introduced a bill that passed in the legislature last year decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of marijuana. It's a roundup of marijuana policy issues today on the show, and you can add your voice to the conversation. Post your thoughts on legalization, decriminalization, or medicinal use of marijuana. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post those thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Again, our number 1-800-639-2211. First up, legalization. Matt Simon is a legislative analyst for the Marijuana Policy Project. Again, that's a Washington, D.C.-based marijuana legalization advocacy group that has said it's targeting Vermont. Matt, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Why Vermont? Why are you targeting Vermont?
Well, we're targeting any state where lawmakers are willing to listen to this, and Vermont is a state that's been ahead of the curve really for the last 10 years on marijuana policy issues. Every time the legislature has seriously deliberated marijuana policy, legislators have ultimately decided to move forward with a significant reform, and we're confident that once they take a hard look at what this kind of policy could look like for Vermont, they'll be wanting to move forward with this as well.
There have been people agitating for years on the issue of legalization, though. Why do you think Vermont would be more open to it now?
Well, we're seeing that so far every step that Vermont's taken has appeared to have been a successful step. Two dispensaries are now open, as you mentioned, serving medical marijuana patients. The legislature was convinced to decriminalize possession of marijuana. And this, the idea of regulating the production and sale of marijuana really just completes the circle. We all know marijuana has to come from somewhere. Currently, it all comes from the illicit market. And we would argue that having it come from a regulated and taxed market is ultimately a smarter policy.
Governor Shumlin, as we just heard, has said he's not going to make this a priority in 2014 and that he's not going to ask the legislature to bring it up in this upcoming session. But last month, he took part in a conference call with major donors to your organization. And just to be on the call, those donors had to pledge to contribute $1,000 to $10,000 to your organization or to pro-pot politicians. So do you think Governor Shumlin actually is, in sort of a backdoor way, making this more of a priority than he's stating?
Well, I certainly don't think he believes it's a priority for the next session, and we've heard that from a number of lawmakers as well, that 2014 will not be the year that this is taken seriously as an issue. We all know that next year is an election year, and everybody will be hearing from voters on this as they seek re-election, and I'm personally confident that 2015 will be a year that we can make a really organized and strong push for this in the legislature.
So you're not aiming to make a push for this in the 2014 session?
Well, we will be engaging legislators on the issue. We'll be having stores open in Colorado and Washington, and everybody will want to see how that goes, I'm sure. So I think the educational process can certainly begin next year, but I don't think we'll be doing any arm twisting in the legislature.
We're talking right now about the legalization of marijuana. The Marijuana Policy Project has targeted Vermont among 10 states that it's looking at for legislation or other kinds of legal action towards legalizing marijuana. And we're hearing from some of you. You can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Jared wrote in to say, as adults, my grandparents lived through Prohibition. I recall my grandfather, a stern and professional man, telling me that during that time, quote, we could always get alcohol. We have long since passed the straight-faced test for marijuana. Popular culture is rife with middle-class reference to pot smoking. Otherwise law-abiding men and women, like my grandparents in their time, do not respect such unjustified limits on their freedoms. On the other hand, BHA wrote in to say, wasn't it just a few months ago that the proponents of decriminalizing marijuana said, no, this isn't an attempt to make it legal. We do not need any more legal mind-altering recreational drugs. And is it a gateway drug? A friend of mine recently said he didn't used to think so until his son went from marijuana all the way to heroin. Matt Simon, what do you think about that?
Well, I think Jared's comment really reflects the sea change of public opinion that we've seen both nationally and within Vermont on this issue. People understand that it's not necessarily a pro-pot position to want to have marijuana regulated and taken out of the illicit market. So I think the comparisons to what happened with alcohol prohibition are absolutely valid. And as far as whether or not it's a gateway, certainly most people who use harder drugs probably used marijuana first. That's because marijuana is widely available and is by far the most commonly used illicit drug. But that doesn't mean that marijuana use causes hard drug use. And I think there's a strong argument that by taking marijuana out of the illicit market so that a drug dealer doesn't sell both marijuana and heroin, that you're actually potentially breaking that link between marijuana and harder drugs.
We got a note from Christy who says, legalize it. If it was legalized and regulated, I'd like to think that it would be distributed in a safer manner than how it is on the streets, going to what you were saying, Matt. Here in Vermont, Christy says, I think there's an enormous amount of supporters. It could be a great boost for Vermont's economy, and it would help lower the unemployment rate. And Peter says, tax it like wine is taxed or like tomatoes. So when you're actually doing this kind of targeted approach, Matt, to getting it legalized in various states, do you approach those issues like the economic issue and the tax issue? I mean, what are you actually doing?
Well, absolutely. We're currently spending an awful lot of money trying to eradicate marijuana from the United States, and it's a lot of money spent with not a lot of results. And I think we should be judging this policy not on its intention, but on its results. Marijuana is literally everywhere, and it's making a lot of money for people who are selling it on the illicit market. Why not have law-abiding, tax-paying businesses go into this business and take it away from the criminals?
So, but then do you talk to law? I mean, what are you actually doing when you're trying to make this push? Are you just trying to get public opinion behind you, or are you going to lawmakers, going to business people and saying, here are some of the benefits that we can see from legalizing?
I think public opinion has already moved into majority support, and we'd like to see it continue to increase. So yes, we're engaging the general public, we're engaging legislators, trying to find out what people's objections are, what are the legitimate public safety concerns that can be addressed by regulation, and try to work out what the best policy would be for Vermont moving forward.
I'm still not feeling like I'm hearing from you on what you're doing with lawmakers, though. I mean, sure, public opinion, is that the main focus then?
Well, We haven't really engaged legislators yet, but we will be making sure they hear from their constituents. We'll be talking to them directly, trying to convince them to have hearings on the issue, trying to convince them to study the issue, and then as it moves into election season, making sure they understand that their constituents do support this, that they won't be voted out of office if they come out in support of regulating marijuana, and try to set things up for 2015. At that point, it will be, you know, much more of a traditional lobbying effort and a grassroots effort to try to convince the legislature to do this and put a bill on Governor Shumlin's desk.
Talking about various issues surrounding marijuana policy today, starting with the current hubbub in the state over legalization. We're talking with Matt Simon with the Marijuana Policy Project, and let's get the take now of Vermont's Public Safety Commissioner Keith Flynn. Commissioner Flynn, nice to have you on the line with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, as you know, Governor Shumlin has said he's open to legalizing marijuana in the state, although he's not likely to make it a priority in 2014. Health Commissioner Harry Chen has said he's open to it. What about you? Are you open to it?
Sure. I think that Matt probably hit it right on the nose when he said that this is something that we need to take a hard look at. And I think that's the governor's position on it, Commissioner Chen's, and that's the approach that we're taking at public safety. We want to take a look at how this would affect public safety in the state and what we can do to continue that. I know that we've certainly put a lot of work into the registry and to the dispensary programs, and they appear to be working very well.
Taking a hard look at it is a little bit different than saying, I am in favor of it and I think it will come to pass, which it seems like is more where Governor Shumlin is standing right now, saying he thinks it should be the law at some point. You seem to be one step behind that.
Well, no, I think the way that the governor expressed it is that it's something we do need to take a look at. I know there are other states, Colorado and Washington, that are both are in different places as far as how they're progressing with this. And like anything, I think it's always prudent to take a good, hard look at any legislation before it's passed to make sure that we know exactly what we're getting and how we're going to deal with it.
But the Public Safety Department isn't against the idea of legalization.
Well, we don't know enough about it yet. We need to see what it would look like, how it would be implemented. So at this point, you know, we're talking about something that doesn't exist. So we'd really need to know more about what the intent of the legislature is and how it would be implemented.
Are you talking at all to your peers in Colorado and Washington or watching what's happening there then?
Yes, I actually have.
What are those conversations like, if you can share some of them?
Sure. A lot of the concerns that that they've had is, particularly in Washington, I know there's been some consideration as to how we're going to get more aggressive in dealing with DUI under the influence of drugs so that we have appropriate testing mechanisms for marijuana so that we can detect when someone's operating a motor vehicle under the influence of marijuana, what the standards for that test would look like, what the measure of someone being impaired in operating a motor vehicle would look like. So a lot of the conversations in that area are focused on some of the unknowns yet. I have spoke with a colleague in California, and they actually have a testing program going on right now in one of the counties where they're doing a saliva test, and they're looking at that and how that could be implemented in.
We got a note from Steve who says, if we do legalize marijuana, shouldn't drug testing be expanded for people in jobs that could affect public health or public safety? Marijuana use has been shown to lower IQ and impair memory, he writes. I know there have been conflicting studies on that, but everyone I've known who's a regular marijuana smoker has a poor memory. Would anyone want their doctor, nurse, or even lab technician doing diagnostic tests to have impaired brain function from marijuana use? What about that question of where we might go with drug testing, Commissioner Flynn?
Well, the drug testing piece is something that I've been very interested in, as I said, particularly because of how it's going to affect the operation of motor vehicles, because one of the things that we're doing, we're constantly striving to make our highways safer, to reduce our fatality rates, and one of the things that we have determined is that traditionally a lot of the impaired drivers that we were seeing were impaired drivers that were under the influence of alcohol. Now we're seeing a trend where we are seeing more operators that are having a combination of alcohol and drugs, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, alcohol, and other drugs. So the testing piece is important. So that's an area where we do need to get better and make sure that whatever we do, we're going to continue to making Vermont safer. And that's another piece that when we're looking at it, that's where the hard look needs to come in.
Commissioner Flynn, in a little while, we're going to be talking about the dispensary system, which has been up and running now for a couple of months, two dispensaries open. How has that been working from your public safety standpoint?
We believe it's working pretty well. First of all, it's interesting that the Justice Department, when they put their directive out, I think back in the end of August, they said that they were essentially going to take a hands-off approach for dealing with producers and sellers in states that have legalized the plant, as long as they put in place a strong and effective state regulatory system. And one of the things that we promised when this system went into place was that we would have such a system in place, and I believe that we do. We currently have 869 patients on the marijuana registry, 114 caregivers, and out of those 869 patients, 486 of them have selected a dispensary. And as you said, we have two dispensaries up and running right now. We're going to have another one up and running tomorrow. And we are currently in the process of reviewing applications for the fourth dispensary. And those applications have been sent to our dispensary application review panel. And they should be making a decision on that within the next couple of weeks.
Keith Flynn is the Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Flynn, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Matt Simon is still with us from the Marijuana Policy Project. Matt, how do you deal with questions about public safety and drug testing like we were just speaking about with Commissioner Flynn?
Well, those are certainly valid questions, and we're doing the best we can to participate in those conversations. Unfortunately, marijuana is not like alcohol in the sense that you can just blow into a breathalyzer and find out exactly how impaired you are. But I do think that science is advancing rapidly, and we may be able to have a roadside test that would be accurate sometime in the not-too-distant future. It's something that I think has been accelerated by the recent reforms, trying to find a better way of determining sobriety on roadsides. And as far as drug testing goes, that's something that, you know, certainly, I wouldn't want my physician to be under the influence of marijuana while operating on me. I wouldn't want him to be drunk either. So it's something we already deal with, and different employers and different professions will have to make some decisions about that moving forward.
We got a note from Lori who says, we're told that the taxation of cannabis would raise vast amounts of revenue for the state of Vermont, but history with other substances proves otherwise. Federal and state taxes collected on alcohol and tobacco amount to just 10% of the estimated total cost of alcohol and tobacco costs related to health care, criminal justice, and the workplace in lost productivity. How would the taxation of marijuana prove otherwise?
Well, I've never been one to promise that it would balance the state's budget or raise vast sums of money. I look at it as turning a big negative in that we're spending an awful lot of money on a policy that isn't showing results and turning it into a positive, actually bringing money into the state that could help address some of these public safety issues. So I would not overpromise on that. The taxation could be significant, but the devil would be in the details on how much money it would actually bring in and where that money would go.
Matt Simon is a legislative analyst for the Marijuana Policy Project, a Washington, D.C.-based marijuana legalization advocacy group. Matt, thanks very much for being on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
After the break, we're going to turn to current Vermont law and take a look at the decriminalization bill that passed this spring, as well as see how one of the new marijuana dispensaries is faring. You can call us with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. If you are one of those 486 patients who have selected a dispensary, how's it going for you? Is the system working? Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We've been looking at the push for the legalization of marijuana in Vermont. Looks like it is going to be an issue in the next couple of years. Brian says the war on marijuana has been a complete and utter failure. It's the largest component of the broader yet equally unsuccessful war on drugs. Marijuana legalization nationwide is an inevitable reality that's approaching much sooner than prohibitionists think, and there's nothing they can do to stop it. But Betsy says no to marijuana as well as any other drug except for medical needs. Well, while we have not yet legalized marijuana, there have been a few new laws relating to marijuana that have passed the legislature. They relate to the purchase of medicinal marijuana at privately run dispensaries and to the decriminalization of small amounts of recreational marijuana. Let's take a look now at both of those laws. And again, listeners, if you want to chime in or ask a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. We'll talk dispensaries first. The state law made accommodations for 4 marijuana dispensaries located around the state. Currently, there are 2 that are operational, one in Burlington and the other in Montpelier. A dispensary in Brandon is set to open tomorrow. And the Department of Public Safety, as we heard from Commissioner Flynn, is reviewing the applications of 5 other potential operators for the 4th spot. By the end of the month, the review panel should have a decision. Shane Lynn is the executive director and founder of Champlain Valley Dispensary in Burlington. Shane, nice to talk with you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. So we spoke with you just after your dispensary opened a few months ago. You opened at the end of June. You've had a couple of months to get your feet under you now. How's business?
Things are going well. You know, each week we're probably having another 5 to 8 people put on the registry list, people that have designated us as their dispensary. And so we're way ahead of the original business plan that I outlaid in my original application. So,
yeah, you originally thought that you'd have in the first year, I think it was 85
patients. Yeah, 85 to 100 people, roughly. At this point, we're up around 225.
What's your maximum that you can take?
Well, there isn't a maximum per dispensary, but there is a maximum that the state has set as 1,000 people can register with dispensaries, you know. So there are 1,000 people between Brandon, myself, and Montpelier dispensaries that people could sign up. So,
although, as he said, there are only 869 patients currently on the registry, and then there are some caregivers who are allowed to grow for those patients.
Correct. And if 1,000 people sign up on the registry, there's still more people could still sign up to be caregivers or to grow themselves.
You are required by law to have a sliding scale for patients who purchase through the dispensary. So what are your prices?
Well, our prices range. We have a range, starts at around $250 and goes up from there. And, you know, we look at people's income. We look at their disability status. There are a lot of factors that goes into basically designating someone for the sliding scale.
And the $250 gets you how much?
That'd be roughly 1 ounce.
And so that sliding scale, you were talking to us before about how you're trying to figure out what the street value of marijuana is and stay right around there, but you've got a lot of overhead costs as well. So are you able to make this sustainable at this price point?
Yes and no. I mean, we're still figuring all that out right now. So, and as a startup company, you know, we have a lot of initial costs. So the longer we're in business, the more we can better understand actually the pricing and what we can offer. And, you know, our goal is to make sure that we do offer affordable medicine to people. But as a new business, and, you know, this is the first time this happening, we still have to be cautious in our projections and how we're running our business.
So when you say yes and no, it sounds like maybe right now you're still running in the red.
Yeah, we still have a lot of debt to pay off. So, and that's going to take a little bit, being in business a little bit longer to pay that off. And once we've achieved that, I think we'll have a better, you know, understanding of our financial situation.
No chance, though, that you might go out of business at this point?
I don't think we're going to go out of business. I do think, though, we have to be conservative and, you know, keep a watchful eye on the books and make sure that we're making, you know, as we start to grow, part of, having over 200 people on the registry at this point is that we're, you know, growing a lot faster than we thought. And so we have to make sure we make the right decisions in investing, in certain equipment that we might need, or even to the number of people that we hire. You know, at this point, we probably have 5 full-time employees and anywhere from 8 to 12 part-time employees. And so that's a lot of labor force for us, and we're just starting to learn how to kind of balance all that and make sure that we are bringing in enough funds to pay for everything.
What about that memo from the Justice Department, from the federal government, that it's not going to go after states that have legalized or decriminalized marijuana? Does that make you rest a little bit easier?
Well, they have put out a memo in the past. And so I think, obviously, actions are louder than words. But I do think that memo was very promising. And it was so promising for us that we've gone ahead and adopted those 8 points and put those into our bylaws for the dispensary to ensure that we're, you know, always maintaining those and being in regulation.
And finally, Shane, what about this idea of legalization? Wouldn't that undercut your business? Where do you stand on that?
Well, we're really not too focused on that just because of, you know, we're really, you know, in it right now and looking at and learning about the whole business itself, how to grow, how to cultivate, and then how to dispense. And there's a lot of intricacies in there. And so we're really staying focused on that. And I think legalization is something that we as a state can definitely look to Colorado and Washington State and see what works and what doesn't work. And I think, you know, taking a very kind of thoughtful, slow approach to that is best. And I think that's where Vermont's law itself, you know, they spent time on this bill and they've really did their homework and it is well regulated. And I think that's going to be prudent in the future if the legalization question does come up to make sure that there are the rules and regulations to manage that well. And I think we look out west, see what they do, and then we can kind of learn here in the state of Vermont what works and what doesn't.
Shane Lynn is the executive director and founder of the Champlain Valley Dispensary in Burlington. Shane, thanks for speaking with us again.
Thank you.
As we look at marijuana policy in Vermont, the newest law on the books went into effect on July 1st. It decriminalizes small amounts of recreational marijuana. Senator Joe Benning of Lindenville was one of the senators who introduced the decriminalization bill that passed this spring. Hello, Senator Benning. Nice to talk with you.
Good afternoon, Jane. Thanks for having me on.
Why did you think that decriminalization was the right way to go when you introduced that bill?
Well, I think as the population ages, and I'm speaking specifically about my own generation, I'm 56, there's a cultural sea change taking place on how we look at drugs and what we do to prosecute people. I was interested in introducing something to get the conversation going about the money that we were spending on actually prosecuting people for what I see as a victimless crime. It never made any sense to me why we were putting people in jail or bringing them through the court and the criminal system in order to prosecute them for something that, frankly, I never saw as a crime. But I was party to that particular bill, decriminalization, because I thought that if there was going to be a discussion, we would need to start it with baby steps, and decriminalizing seemed to me to be the way to go.
So if decriminalizing is a baby step, does that mean that you are supportive ultimately of the legalization of recreational marijuana?
Well, I think the next baby step in the process is to study how the decriminalization process has worked. And there is actually a bill in the legislature right now, and I'm sorry I don't have the number off the top of my head. In fact, you're catching me between court appearances. But there is a bill in the legislature that a few of us have signed on to that calls for studying just what it would mean if we go to legalization. Personally, I am in favor of reaching that objective at some point in time, and it's not because I smoke marijuana. I have no interest in smoking marijuana. I do have an interest in bringing an intelligent conversation to the table, and I think that this baby step process is moving us in the direction of legalization.
So you then also are not planning to bring this up as an actual bill for passage, the legalization of marijuana in 2014?
I don't think it's going to work in 2014 because people are still trying to get used to the idea of decriminalization. I would be in favor, however, of studying the issue of legalization to see how it's working in Washington and Colorado and to figure out what exactly it would all mean for the state of Vermont if we ended up in that direction. It doesn't cost a lot for the legislature to do a study, And I think it would behoove us to have all of our ducks lined up appropriately if, in fact, we take the following step, which would be legalization.
We just have a couple of seconds left, Senator Benning, but so far, since the law was enacted on July 1st to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana for first and second offenses, are you seeing it as successful in what you've been witnessing?
So far, I think it's working very well. I was led to believe about 3 weeks ago that about 120 people had been cited for judicial summonses, the alternative process of prosecuting these days, a simple citation. So I think it's actually begun to go in the direction we want it to go, and that conversation needs to continue.
Joe Benning, a Republican from Lindenville, is one of the state senators who introduced the marijuana decriminalization bill that passed last session. Senator Benning, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we're going to learn a little bit about the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Awards, the books for children that are on the list that kids all around the state read and love all year and then vote on a winner. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every year, thousands of Vermont students in grades 4 through 8 read the books on the Dorothy Canfield Fisher list. Come spring, the students vote for a winner. Today, Vermont Edition is introducing a new series, Dorothy's List. Each month, we'll dive into one of the books that's nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award and hear from the author and the readers themselves. VPR's Amy Noyes is our guide.
And that close-up part might be in a part of the world that isn't discovered.
Oh,
but their dad went I'm not sure.
In the library at U32 Middle School in Montpelier, we meet a group of students and librarian Vicki Palmer. They just finished reading our first book on Dorothy's List, The Expeditioners and the Treasure of Drowned Man's Canyon. It's the first book in an adventure series written by Vermont author S.S. Taylor and illustrated by Catherine Roy. The story follows three orphaned siblings in a futuristic society, yet everything is powered by Victorian-era technologies such as steam engines and clockworks. Palmer talks with the middle schoolers about the writing style known as steampunk.
It's kind of a subgenre, okay? So the genre being fantasy, or in some cases it could be science fiction, and then the steampunk is the subgenre, and steampunk was just the phrase was just coined in the 80s. So, but there were some things written way before the 80s that are kind of steampunky.
Eighth grader Noah Whitkey says if he could ask the author, S.S. Taylor, a question about the expeditioners, it would be this.
The steampunk aspects of this novel were really cool. What were some of the things that inspired you to write about it?
We put Noah's question and the questions of other students to S.S. Taylor.
I'm so glad that you liked the steampunk aspects of the novel, Noah, because I like them too. And as you can imagine, it was really fun to dream up the gadgets and to, you know, sort of come up with the technology background, if you will, of this world. And that came from, for me, thinking about a world in which all of the computers have crashed. We've in my alternate future, we've become very dependent on computers. And when there's a mass crash where basically everything digital, everything networked goes down, people are all of a sudden left to have to sort of pick and choose from archaic technologies and figure out which ones might work for this new world in which explorers are going out and finding new places.
The steampunk theme was on the mind of another U32 eighth grader, Alex Riley.
What inspired you to write about this kind of steampunk novel rather than another kind of fiction novel?
I actually didn't set out to write a steampunk novel. It was, I think, this world, which is actually not strictly steampunk, but probably something like futuristic, you know, post-digital steampunk or something, where that world came from. It really came out of the characters and this idea of the truth about the globe being obscured in digital technology.
The expeditioners in the title are the three main characters, siblings Xander, Kit, and MK. The nickname comes from their father, a famed explorer named Alexander West. The Expeditioners is told from the point of view of Kit, the middle son. He got his looks and his smarts from a mother he barely remembers. MK is his hot-headed little sister, who has a knack for all things mechanical. His older brother Xander is the spitting image of his dad, who's gone missing. The government said Alexander West died on an expedition. Eighth grader Ruby Lamb wants to know more about how S.S. Taylor wrote the characters.
Why is it that the three protagonists, the expeditioners, are so different from one another?
Taylor says she wrote the characters with sibling rivalry in mind, but these siblings have to get along without any parents to help them.
So Xander West, the oldest kid in the family, is very brave. He looks exactly like their father. Everyone assumes that he will be the one to follow in their father's footsteps. Kit West, the narrator of the book, is a little more unsure of himself and unsure of his place in the family, I think. And yet he is in some ways the one who really is the heir to their father's legacy. And of course, MK West, their younger sister, is a mechanic, an engineer. She loves fixing things, and she's also quite brave, although sometimes not in her best interest. So I wanted to kind of explore how these three siblings could all love each other and get along, and yet be jealous of each other and feel competition with each other.
Eighth grader Rena Schwartz picks up the question of who gets to tell the expeditioner's story.
Why did you choose Kit as the main character instead of Xander, MK, or Suki?
I chose to make Kit the narrator because I really wanted to tell the story from the point of view of a kid who isn't sure who he is, what his purpose in life is, as I think all of us struggle with that question, certainly when we're 13 and throughout our lives probably. But I wanted to tell the story from the point of view of someone who was coming to understand his own skills and his own talents.
As the novel opens, the expeditioners find themselves in possession of a secret map drawn by their father. It shows a place that's not found on any of the government's official maps. Here's S.S. Taylor reading a passage where the kids are trying to find out more about the mysterious map, but Kit's not sure they've asked the right person for help.
Have you ever seen someone who is very happy or very excited about something try to keep himself from acting happy and excited? That was what Mr. Mountmorris seemed to be doing. As he looked at the map, his hands were almost vibrating over it, as though he could barely stop himself from seizing it and hugging it to his body. But he kept himself very rigid, and after a couple of seconds, he sat straight up in his chair and said in a calm voice, "This is very interesting indeed. May I ask where you found it?" I tried to keep my voice even. Around, with some of Dad's things.
U32 middle school librarian Vicky Palmer asks the kids if they believe the expeditioner's dad really died.
Do you remember at one point, I think Kit and maybe MK both mentioned that they thought they might find their dad when they actually got into the...
Yeah. Or at least thought about it, in one of the little contexts.
Do you think he's still alive?
I think he's alive. Well, it just, all the stuff that BNDL was saying about him, it just didn't really line up. Mm-hmm. I think he's still alive, and I kind of thought with... when Hala kept saying, we have this thing that we have to show you, I kind of thought that it might have been the dad, but then it really wasn't. Mm-hmm. So I think he's still out there.
I think that the dad is dead, but I kind of think the mom's alive. I don't know if this is a little bit crazy of me, but I feel like the dad, I feel like the author has done so many cool things, with twists and unpredictable things. I think that she kind of thinks that you will think that he'll be alive, and I think he's going to be dead. And something else crazy like that is going to happen that you wouldn't think.
Plot twists and turns are one of the things that makes The Expeditioners such an exciting read. Another fun aspect of the book is all the cool gadgets that the kids discover in their explorer vests their father made for them. Seventh grader Lucy Wood has this question for S.S. Taylor.
I was wondering how you were able to come up with so many different kinds of gadgets for the characters.
the gadgets were one of the best things about writing this book. I loved dreaming up the gadgets. I've always been interested in gadgetry. I had a James Bond obsession when I was in junior high, and maybe it comes from that. But I came up with them largely through the process of writing the book. I would put them in a situation and say, all right, what gadget would help Kit get out of this situation? Would it be an umbrella that pops out of the back of his explorer's vest? Or would it be a special knife that also has a magnifying glass on it? What would it be? And it was really fun to come up with those. And probably there are a few gadgets that I just threw in there because I just thought they were really cool.
Those cool gadgets are likely to come in handy in the expeditioner's next adventure, or the one after that. S.S. Taylor says she currently has 7 books plotted out in the series. Right now, she's working on book number 2. Meanwhile, kids around Vermont are reading The Expeditioners and The Treasure of Drowned Man's Canyon as part of the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Program. It's one of 30 books nominated for this year's award. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
Next month in our series, Dorothy's List, we'll be exploring Steve Sheinkin's nonfiction book, Bomb, The Race to Build and Steal the World's Most Dangerous Weapon. It's a real-life spy story about the plotting, risks, deceit, and genius that went into creating and deploying the atomic bomb. Here's a sneak preview, read by Camel's Hump Middle School 7th grader Sonia Nussbaum.
Harry Gold had been living a double life for 17 years. Overwhelmed by exhaustion, he turned to the FBI agents. They were still waiting for an answer. "Yes, I am the man," Harry Gold said. He slumped a little lower in his chair. "There is a great deal more to this story. It goes way back," he said. "I would like to tell it all."
That's an excerpt from Bomb, the next selection in our series, Dorothy's List, about the books nominated for the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Apple pie season is in full swing around the state, but perhaps no community in Vermont can rival the pie output of Charlotte. That's where 77-year-old Martha Perkins is hard at work with her group of volunteers, churning out hundreds of pies. As Claudia Marshall reports, for Perkins, it's strictly a labor of love.
At the top of a steep hill overlooking Charlotte sits a small old church, the kitchen all but overflowing with apples and dough.
I had friends yesterday who had friends from England. Where did they go? They went apple picking.
3 grandmothers are trading stories and assembling pies in a sunny kitchen while the oven warms up.
Guys.
Oh, what?
I put more cider in.
You're kidding me.
No.
Something's gone wrong with the dough today, and they're scrambling to fix it.
On a normal day, we would have probably pies in the oven by now.
At the center of the action is Martha Perkins, a white-haired dynamo who says she's seen by some as a nuisance, but she certainly gets the job done.
Now, Martha, should we get these 8 in the oven
yes.
as well?
Yes, yep.
Martha has to do the special.
She has to
put the blessing on the pies.
I am the quality control manager.
They produce 32 pies per session, 64 a week for 8 weeks. That's more than 500 pies total. Last year, they raised nearly $5,000, though the pies are not as fancy as some.
Cabot butter, local flour and local apple, local cider and local apples.
The apples come from an orchard in Shoreham, originally owned by Martha's great-grandfather. The farm has been in Martha's family for 5 generations, and that's where she learned to bake. 5 years of volunteer pie production has helped refine the recipe. The pie-buying public knows none of this as they drive by on Churchill Road, and they're not even told part of the proceeds support the church's charitable work.
Yeah, I've been trying to get one of these for 2 years. It's the first time I've ever.
The pies sell on their own merit. Martha makes sure of that. She doesn't just bake. She paints and posts signs, enlists volunteers, and even stands by the road in front of the church twice a week herself, every Wednesday and Friday from 4 to 6, in all kinds of weather, alternately waving down cars with a bright red flag or wielding a red and white polka-dotted umbrella.
We're the coolest grandmothers you ever saw.
As Martha Perkins puts it, somehow it works. For VPR News, I'm Claudia Marshall in Charlotte.
And that will do it for today's show. We're still getting emails from our conversation earlier this hour about legalizing marijuana. Dean in Thetford Center says, like all psychoactive drugs, marijuana is pleasure for some and poison for others. Are we ready for the end of the war on marijuana and the escalation of the never-ending treatment of each new wave of those for whom it is poison? And Cannabis Pro says, let's hope when Vermont legalizes marijuana that it will make it a cottage industry, not big business. You can share your position on marijuana legalization on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.